Kimberly McAndrew clocked out of work 40 minutes early. It was a slow day, and walked out the back door into the parking lot, from which she seemingly vanished into thin air. When her sister arrived to pick her up, Kim was nowhere to be found, and within hours, the city of Halifax was searched by friends, family, and police, but they couldn't find a trace of Kim. Over the past 30 years, the investigation has taken many twists and turns. Persons of interest with violent criminal histories and bizarre obsessions were shown to be in the area at the time, and tips came in from all sources. Store employees, local residents, prison inmates, and even an alleged psychic. It was a complicated investigation going 100 miles per hour in 1,000 different directions. Dozens of theories were analyzed, thousands of tips tracked, and a handful of suspects considered. Yet Kim's fate has eluded all who have sought the truth. Could it be the work of a serial killer, a local who developed a fatal attraction, or perhaps someone close to Kim who earned her trust and then exploited it? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 117, The Disappearance of Kimberly McAndrew. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we examine the mysterious disappearance of 19-year-old Kimberly McAndrew. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. You can also find the show on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions on the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. 19-year-old Kimberly McAndrew clocked out early, stepped outside, and vanished. What happened that fateful Saturday has remained a mystery for more than 30 years. This is episode 117, The Disappearance of Kimberly McAndrew. At approximately 4:20 p.m. on Saturday, August 12, 1989, 19-year-old Kim McAndrew clocked out of Canadian Tire, a popular retail chain where she worked as a cashier, and disappeared into the busy streets of Halifax. Her supervisor had agreed to let her out early, something which excited Kim, who was eagerly looking forward to that night's plans. It was her boyfriend's birthday, and the couple, along with one of Kim's sisters and her boyfriend, were going to the Busker Festival, an event which included street artists, magicians, and of course, fireworks. It was set to be an evening filled with fun and laughter, but instead would become a nightmare which has endured for more than 30 years. Kimberly Ann McAndrew was born on January 17, 1970, to parents Audrey and Cyril. She was one of six siblings, having four sisters, Heather, Erin, Carla, and Megan, and one brother, James. Kim grew up in Parsboro, a rural community in Cumberland County, Nova Scotia, and by all accounts, she was a brilliant, sweet, and compassionate young woman who had somewhat of a shy personality. Her sister, Megan, later told reporters, quote, "She was quiet if out in public, but around family and friends, she was funny, goofy, and liked to make others laugh and certainly laugh a lot," end quote. In most depictions, friends and family are quick to describe her as an introverted woman, the kind who loved the small-town feel of Parsboro, being somewhat intimidated by a larger city like Halifax. Even in her hometown, though, with a population of just 1,200, she didn't like being alone while she was out and about. In an August 2014 interview, her younger sister Megan explained to the Global News, quote, "Kim was not a girl that went off on her own at all. She didn't even like walking downtown Parsboro by herself," end quote. In Parsboro, Kim developed a close circle of friends. She was fun, exuberant, and prone to fits of laughter. She loved music, specifically singer-songwriter Brian Adams, and she started dating a local boy. She would later go missing on his birthday. Kim's family was tight. six siblings developing strong bonds between two loving and very involved parents. Kim's father, Cyril, was an officer with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, a job he would hold for more than 30 years, retiring the same month that his daughter disappeared. But the job didn't end there for him. He would spend the rest of his life investigating Kim's disappearance, dedicating every moment of it to trying to find what became of his daughter that sunny afternoon in August of 89. There's a plethora of questions, though perhaps one which stands out starkly in terms of the circumstances surrounding the last day Kim was seen. How does a young woman who doesn't walk off on her own, even in her small hometown, end up vanishing in broad daylight from the busy streets of Halifax? Halifax is the capital of the province of Nova Scotia and stands in direct contrast to the small town of Parsborough with a population of over 400,000. That's more than 300 times the population of Kim's hometown. Friends and family have suggested time and again that it makes little sense. If Kim were hesitant to walk to the Parsborough downtown by herself, why would she set out into Halifax without so much as a call or a request for company? It's an answer no one possesses that has resulted in a lot of speculation, though for many it seems quite clear. If Kim disappeared into the streets, it's unlikely that it was by her own choice. Kim came to Halifax for school. She was set to attend Dalhousie University as an undergraduate that semester. While she may have been overwhelmed by the big city, so to speak, she did have family there that made the transition easier. Two of Kim's sisters were living in Halifax at the time, sharing an apartment on Maxwell Avenue in Halifax's North End. Logistically, it was a great place for Kim to stay, as Dalhousie University was just 3.5 kilometers or 2 miles to the south. The Canadian Tire location at which Kim was hired on for the summer was nearly dead center between the two locations, with both her apartment and her school falling within a 2 kilometer radius of the store. This is not only what made things easier in terms of transportation, all reporting suggesting that Kim was given rides to work often, but it also allowed Kim to slowly acclimate to a smaller area of the city, expanding at her own pace rather than having to traverse it all at once. I should note, I've seen several reports that the apartment was a 15-minute walk from the store. However, every different option I've chosen through Google Maps shows it at the shortest as being a 30-minute walk. Even if Kim walked faster than average, the shortest I could make that trip was 24 minutes. Kim still didn't feel completely comfortable in the city. At least, she didn't feel comfortable alone. In an interview with The Coast, a local Halifax paper, investigator Tom Martin talked about his investigation into Kim's background, explaining in part that she preferred to make the trip home to Parsborough to stay with her parents on nights when her sisters wouldn't be sleeping at the apartment. He went on to explain that Kim was not an adventurous type and preferred the safety and comfort of being with friends and family. Her sister Megan further expanded on this, defining her sister by saying she wasn't a risk taker and, quote, "there was no way she was just off doing something independently," end quote. The night of Saturday, August 12th was planned out in advance. Kim would work her shift at Canadian Tire and get off at 5. Her sister, Heather, along with her boyfriend and Kim's boyfriend, who was celebrating his birthday, would get together and head over to the Busker Festival for a night of fireworks and fun. According to everything we know, Kim was in great spirits that morning and eagerly anticipating the night. She also had something else to look forward to. On Tuesday the 15th, she was scheduled to have her braces removed, and according to everyone who knew her, Kim wouldn't have missed that appointment for anything in the world. Heather dropped Kim off that morning outside the employee entrance, not knowing this would be the last time she would see her sister. Subsequent interviews with coworkers didn't bring up any issues. Kim was her usual polite, shy, and hardworking self. She worked as a cashier throughout the day, though as the afternoon wore on, the shoppers became fewer and fewer. It was a beautiful Saturday, the festival was in town, and by 4 p.m. most people were either getting ready for their evenings or firing up their barbecues. As a result of the slowdown in customers, Kim was allowed to clock out early. I should note, I've never found out whether or not Kim was offered to leave early or if she requested to leave early. What we do know for certain is that she clocked out at 4:20 p.m., 40 minutes before her sister would be arriving to pick her up. According to employee accounts, she walked out the back door of the store and vanished. I should take a moment to discuss the layout. Canadian Tire is located along the north edge of Quinpool Road, number 6203, which runs from Roby Street in the east to the Armdale Roundabout in the west, stretching approximately 3 kilometers or 1.9 miles. There's a main entrance to Canadian Tire facing Quinpool Road, but there's also a back exit which is near the automotive services garage of the store and spills out into a parking lot housed between Monastery Lane and Quinpool Plaza. It's a small, rectangular parking lot which services Canadian Tire, as well as several other storefronts in a small strip mall. Today, the parking lot faces the Quinpool Courts Apartments to the north. In an interview with 95.7 News, Megan explained that the back parking area and surrounding buildings are much the same today as they were in 1989. This is the area Kim was last seen, walking out the back door into this parking lot. According to the Doe Network, Kim was dressed in ankle-length navy cotton slacks with slash pockets in the front and one pocket in the back, a white, short-sleeved Esprit t-shirt with red and green squares, a navy cotton oversized cardigan, and jade green flat-heeled slip-on loafers. She was also carrying a blue bag, which she always carried to and from work. 40 minutes later, at approximately 5 p.m., Heather pulled in to pick up her sister, as she had done numerous times before. Typically, Kim would be there waiting, but occasionally she'd run a few minutes late, as often happens when you're working in a retail store. This Saturday wasn't that busy, but Heather had no reason to suspect anything strange about Kim not coming out promptly. However, as time kept passing, she began growing concerned. After an unspecified amount of time, she stepped out of the car and walked into the store looking for her sister. When she couldn't find her, she asked around, and it was at that time that she was informed that Kim had left nearly an hour earlier and no one had seen her since. Heather wasn't sure what to make of the situation. It wasn't like Kim to disappear without at least a call, and while she could have decided to walk home, she'd likely have taken the familiar route, the one that Heather herself would have driven that afternoon to pick her up. In hopes that Kim may have made the unlikely choice to walk home without a call, or maybe she had missed the call, Heather made the drive back to the apartment, looking for her sister all along the way, but she never saw her. Upon arriving at the apartment, she entered hoping to see Kim inside, but there was no sign that Kim had been there after leaving for work that morning. The more time passed, the more it seemed likely that something had gone wrong. It was completely out of character for Kim to go off on her own, and considering the plans for that evening, there's no way she would have just run off somewhere. Unsure of what to do and having exhausted all possibilities, Kim's other sister Erin made the difficult phone call home. Megan remembers it well. 16 at the time and living with her parents, she explained Erin's call to the Global News, saying, quote, "She asked for my dad on the phone. I knew something was wrong immediately. That's when she told my parents Kim hadn't come home from work," end quote. The Halifax Regional Police were contacted, and Kim was reported missing. The search kicked off almost immediately, with investigators beginning in the area of Canadian Tire and working their way outward to try and track where Kim may have gone, and anyone who may have seen her. Kim's family were involved, coming to Halifax to help with the search. Flyers were produced bearing Kim's image in hopes that people in Halifax would recall seeing her that afternoon or evening, but investigators were faced with a stark lack of information. It seemed, for the most part, no one had seen Kim since she'd left work that afternoon. There was initially a debate, which in some ways still goes on today, about where Kim might have gone. While some believe she could have chosen to walk home, disappearing somewhere along the way, others argued that Kim had likely not left that parking lot of her own will. As the media got involved in the case within the first few days of the investigation, news of Kim's disappearance spread through Halifax and subsequently all of Canada rapidly. As a result of the coverage, hundreds of tips came pouring into investigators, though most were alleged sightings which could never be confirmed. Witnesses reported seeing Kim all over Canada within days after her disappearance, and within weeks, there were sightings being reported in the United States as well. Cutting through all of the information coming in, investigators were able to rule out a large number of tips quickly. However, one tip authorities received held more promise than the others, and while it's never been completely confirmed, it exists as a dividing line in the investigation to this day. Just across the river from Halifax, The community of Dartmouth, part of the Halifax Regional Municipality, is home to the Penhorn Mall. The mall itself, in Penhorn Plaza, sits 8 kilometers or 5 miles away to the east of the Canadian Tire on Quinpool Road. Traveling from Canadian Tire to the Penhorn Plaza requires crossing one of two bridges, the closer to which is the Angus L. MacDonald Bridge, the other being located in the northern tip of Halifax, several kilometers out of the way. An employee working at the Gardenia Flower Shop in the mall notified authorities that a young woman fitting Kim's description had been in the shop the afternoon that she disappeared. Reportedly, the young woman purchased a single rose and a balloon at the shop, which made investigators believe this could have been a legitimate sighting of Kim. It was, after all, her boyfriend's birthday. While investigators latched onto the sighting at the time, and it remains listed on all official missing person documents related to Kim today, there are those who believe the sighting was probably an error. In order for Kim to have arrived at that flower shop without anyone giving her a ride, she'd have had to have walked somewhere between 75 and 90 minutes one way. For those who were close to Kim, it seemed unlikely she'd have just gone off on her own on this long walk. It's not her personality type. Kim knew her sister was picking her up at 5. If she had left the store at exactly 4:20 when she got off and began her walk, she wouldn't even have made it to the flower shop until 5:30 at the earliest, and then she'd have to walk back. It would take her another hour to an hour and a half just to get to the store, let alone the additional 20 to 30 minutes walk to the apartment. This would mean that had Kim made this walk, she couldn't have expected to get together with her sister and boyfriend until 7 p.m. at the earliest, which wouldn't have made much sense given the plans for the evening. Why not just wait until your sister came to pick you up and ask for a ride to the shop? Why not bring it up before even going to work? Making things even more bizarre was another detail pointed out by investigator Tom Martin. There was a flower shop along the route Kim would have taken if she had simply chosen to walk home. While this sighting is in the official report and still considered today, many think that this sighting is more than likely a misidentification. There are some, though, who have argued that maybe Kim didn't make that walk, but instead caught a ride with someone. Kim was shy and introverted, wasn't adventurous, and according to friends and family, never would have gone anywhere with a stranger. That's made some wonder whether or not Kim could have run into someone she knew who offered her a ride and something went wrong along the way. Of course, that would raise another question. If someone were planning to do something to Kim, why would they bring her to the flower shop in the first place? It wouldn't make sense to risk being spotted if foul play was the intent. Maybe it didn't begin that way, though, or maybe Kim never walked into that flower shop at all. To this day, no one can know for sure. Unfortunately, whether or not the flower shop sighting was legitimate, police struggled to find any evidence to suggest where Kim may have been or what might have happened to her. Running away was quickly ruled out. There was far too many people around her saying it wasn't her style, and she had too much going on right where she was. On that possibility, Megan told the CBC, quote, "You know, I used to make fun of her because she wouldn't walk to downtown Parsboro alone and would make me go with her to get a Diet Coke. That's not the personality of someone that has just gone off." End quote. In addition to Kim's disinterest in wandering off, nothing was missing from the apartment. No clothing, no personal items, nothing but the very clothes and items Kim had with her that Saturday afternoon. To this day, there's been no activity on her bank account, and while there are sporadic sightings, nothing has ever led to confirmation. No sighting has ever been legitimized. There were a lot of them, hundreds, but each lead brought investigators to a dead end, each hope dashed with the absence of a resolution. Kim's father, Cyril, retired from the RCMP the same month she disappeared, but he never really left the job. Instead, it became a personal investigation. Cyril took all of his years of experience and put them to work in trying to find his daughter, an investigation which would continue through the rest of his life. Unfortunately, it would be a painstaking task, one which would cause him to confront the challenges of a case with no evidence, no confirmed sightings, no anything. Kim MacAndrew walked out of Canadian Tire and disappeared without a trace, and the theories from day one took investigators in a myriad of different directions. One tip, which came in early, suggested that Kim had been abducted by a local human trafficking operation tied to a man who had come to know her through her job. In his book, Somebody's Daughter, author Fonce Jessam explained how John Elliott, an investigator for the RCMP, was contacted by an informant who alleged that Kim had been picked up by the trafficker not far from her job that afternoon. Elliott brought this information to another investigator, Brad Sullivan, and together they enacted Operation Heart, which focused on tracking down a trafficking and forced sex work ring in the area. The operation would spread far and wide, tracking down multiple suspects with ties to other abductions. But the more the two worked, the less they began to believe that Kim may have been forced into this ring. According to Sullivan, it was more likely that Kim had been abducted by a trafficker, but when it was learned that her father was a police officer, she was likely killed to cover up the crime. Keeping her alive would have been too risky. The chance that someone would find her, knowing how hard not only Kim's father but his colleagues would work to track her down, was just not a chance worth taking. If indeed Kim had been taken by one of the men investigated in Operation Heart, no one ever managed to track that man down. Either way, notices were sent across Canada. Files on Kim were shared in hopes that officers working vice would keep an eye out, but no news ever came. Tom Martin, who worked as an undercover drug officer at the time, became aware of Kim's case early on and did what he could to contribute. When asked about the early theories of the sex trafficking, Martin was somewhat dismissive, telling The Coast, quote, "Investigation 101, don't believe your informant too much," end quote. He felt that statement applied to the flower shop sighting as well, though he doesn't think in that case that it was done on purpose, it was just a mistake. However, this would not be the last time an informant would go to authorities claiming to have information about Kim's abduction. The McAndrew family suffered a painful experience 2 years later, in 1991. The organization Child Find Nova Scotia reported that Kim had been found alive and well in a London, Ontario hospital, having given birth to a baby. When the family received the news of the finding, they were both excited and suspicious. However, their suspicions were soon proven true when the woman was positively identified as not being Kim. The two women were similar, shared a birthday, but beyond that, there was no connections to Kim. In an interview with The Province, Kim's mother Audrey explained, quote, "At the beginning, we really weren't too sure it was Kimberly. Then you sort of listened to everybody else. All the media and Child Find kept saying it was Kimberly. So we thought, well, maybe it could be. Today, we're just extremely disappointed," end quote. At the time, a $5,000 reward was available for information leading to Kim. On January 1, 1992, 18-year-old Andrea Lynn King took a flight from New Westminster, British Columbia to Halifax. She called her family to tell them she'd arrived and would contact them the next day, but that call never came. 2 days passed before her family reported her missing on January 4th, and much like in the case of Kim McAndrew, a large search effort was deployed. No sign of Andrea was found until December 22nd, nearly a year later, when police discovered her remains. She had been murdered and left in a wooded area less than 100 yards off a dead-end road in Sackville Business Park. In consideration that there could be a link between the murder of Andrea King and the disappearance of Kim, and that the person or persons responsible might show up, police officers and Kim's father attended Andrea's funeral to make notes of anyone out of the ordinary who attended. Photographs were taken of attendees as they came and went, but as of this date, there were no developments in either case from that funeral. For Cyril, it was a painful experience and in many ways showed that, as the years began passing, more and more investigators leaned toward the likelihood of murder. Andrea King's murder also remains unsolved today. Several years would pass before anything new would develop in the case, but in 1995, some 6 years after Kim was last seen, there were two instances in which investigators were given hope that they might be able to find the then 25-year-old. One of these came from information from a prison inmate serving time for sexual offenses. According to this informant, Kim had been murdered, and her body had been buried in Sir Sanford Fleming Park. The park, located in the Jollymore community of Halifax, was just a 5-kilometer or 3-mile westward drive from Canadian Tire. The park itself shares some of the coastline across from the campus of Dalhousie University. Investigators poured over the park and for 3 days excavated different areas to no avail. The inmate, who had initially given the tip, had alleged that he had witnessed two of his former associates both murder and bury Kim in that park. However, he couldn't maintain a consistent story and would go on to fail at least one polygraph administered to him. Almost simultaneous to the police searching the park, Halifax Police Constable David McDonald was doing something a little more out of the ordinary. He was consulting with a psychic. This information didn't become public until 2015, when the editor of the Halifax Examiner came across tape recordings of three sessions held between the psychic and McDonald. According to the Skeptical Inquirer, in October of 1995, the Halifax police hired alleged psychic Noreen Renier to consult on Kim's case. The Skeptical Inquirer, for the record, is the official journal for the Center of Inquiry, a nonprofit organization developed to, quote, encourage careful, rational, critical examination of unusual claims, such as psychics, for instance. According to her own website, Renier is a psychic detective who has consulted on more than 600 unsolved cases, though the number of cases resolved due to her assistance is strangely absent from the listing, outside of 19 testimonials, or 3.17% of 600. Rainier's website goes on to explain that she operates through psychometrics, meaning that she physically touches items related to victims or suspects, and then she begins tuning into the crime or person. To her credit, she does express that her interpretations are not going to be 100% accurate, and law enforcement should only call a psychic as a last resort. On the bright side, it's only $750 for a 1 to 2 hour session. Three sessions took place via telephone between Renier and McDonald. Kim's sister Heather and her mother Audrey were involved in the first call alongside McDonald, though they were not present on the two subsequent calls. I should note, Renier claims to become the person she is seeking, so she starts bouncing back and forth between being Kim and being Noreen. After Renier alleges to have contacted Kim, she makes several flawed statements, including claiming that she left the south entrance of the building, even though witnesses put her leaving the north exit, and discussing distances she had to walk to a car, but Kim didn't have a car, and with her describing the atmosphere that day as being wet, which it surely was not. I could go on, but you get the general idea. Outside of the errors, there's a lot of the stuff like there's a street that starts with an S or a man with a short name. It would be funny if it wasn't so damn sad. Ultimately, the first call ends with the suggestion that there's a park over a bridge and Kim is in a cylinder, which is later interpreted to be a well. The second call goes deeper into this, pinpointing the location of Point Pleasant Park, located south of Dalhousie University on the peninsula. Wells were searched in this area in early 1996, though nothing of significance was found connected to Kim's disappearance. In the third call, for some reason, Rainier begins by explaining that they have to throw away all the information she'd given in the first two calls and start fresh. This conversation moved into the possibility of Kim being in a pond, which was mistaken for a well. Two ponds were drained, but ultimately nothing was found. While Renier concluded that Kim would be found by Christmas, 25 years and counting seems a bit of a stretch to fit, and sadly, her family and investigators were no further along than they had been previously, except maybe out some more money. Time began moving forward, and while Kim's family tried to hold on to her memory and the goal of seeing her found, the years began stretching out with little or no development. Kim's father, Cyril, devoted the rest of his life to trying to find his daughter. Sadly, on September 4, 2004, 15 years after Kim vanished, Cyril passed away at the age of 72 after a battle with cancer. His daughter, Megan, when speaking with the CBC, explained, quote, "My dad died searching for my sister. It was really tough. Doubly so just because that was his life after she went missing, was finding her, and you just thought there would be some kind of karma that would let that happen, but life doesn't always work out that way." End quote. Another 9 years would pass before there was any new information or possibilities connected to Kim's disappearance. Then, in 2013, a new search was conducted which had ties to a well-known inmate, Andrew Paul Johnson, who had been on investigators' radar for years as possibly being involved in Kim's abduction, as well as being considered a person of interest in the murder of Andrea King, along with nearly a dozen other unsolved murders going back to 1976. Johnson has an extensive history of crime. In 1992, he pled guilty to imprisoning and sexually assaulting a former girlfriend. In 1997, he was arrested when he was caught masturbating in his car while watching young girls playing in a suburban Halifax neighborhood. A warrant was issued for his arrest when he made sexual advances on a 12-year-old girl, claiming that he had been a photographer for a teen fashion magazine. He'd been enrolled in a Dartmouth area sexual offender treatment program, though he eventually fled to British Columbia. However, there were a few details about his time there which heightened investigators' curiosities about his possible connection to Kim. Firstly, according to the Coast, Johnson had written a bizarre essay about Kim. Reportedly, during his time in the treatment program, as an attempt at a therapeutic exercise, psychiatrist Joseph Gabriel gave an assignment for Johnson and others to write about sexual assault from the point of view of the victim. It was hoped this might help them open their minds to the myriad of horrors a victim experiences. While this may have worked for some, in the case of Johnson, it took a very disturbing turn. He wrote his essay from the point of view of Kimberly McAndrew. Now, whether this was written out of fact or out of fantasy, no one can say for sure, but it certainly drew attention. So much so that Gabriel reported it to authorities. When investigators dug into Johnson, familiar with his past, they couldn't help but think there could be a potential link between him and Kim. Their investigation led to another curiosity. According to a telephone directory dated 1989, at the time of Kim's disappearance, Johnson was dating a woman who lived in the Quinpool Tower Apartments, directly across the street from Canadian Tire. According to the Examiner, police flew out to British Columbia to interview Johnson, but things didn't turn out well and they were unable to get any information to form a solid link. This does, however, put Johnson in the area when Kim disappeared. According to freelance journalist Stephen Kimber, during the investigation into Johnson's background, authorities recovered a makeup compact amongst his possessions. That compact was later identified by Andrea King's mother as belonging to her daughter. That same year of 1997, there were reports of Johnson posing as a police officer trying to lure young girls into his vehicle, one being listed as 12 years old. When police tracked down Johnson, they found a 20-year-old intellectually disabled woman locked in his car. Police also recovered what they described as a rape kit in the vehicle, which included pornography, a mask, handcuffs, a meat cleaver, lubricant, and packing tape. Johnson was sent to prison after pleading guilty, and while he was questioned about both Kim and Andrea, he did not acknowledge any involvement in the crimes. According to the Coast, at the time, DNA samples were taken from Johnson for future testing against evidence, but when that evidence was sought for testing years later, it couldn't be located. So that brings us back to 2013, when the RCMP, in a joint operation with the Halifax Police, launched a search into a property in Shad Bay, some 26 kilometers or 16 miles to the southwest of Halifax. This property belonged to the brother of Andrew Paul Johnson. While police have never discussed exactly what they were looking for, speculation was rampant at the time that they were searching for Kim's body along with other alleged victims. Reports of the time describe a three-day search with authorities removing items from the garage, sifting through dirt, and placing a large blue tarp over a shed located on the property. However, while some items were removed from the property by investigators, the details of that search and what, if anything, was found has never been publicly revealed. We do know that there were no human remains recovered, according to social media, from investigating authorities. When Tom Martin was asked about Johnson, he told the CBC, quote, "Johnson is a person I would call a very, very strong person of interest," end quote. However, to date, no solid evidence has ever been found linking Johnson to Kim, nor any of the other victims outside of Andrea King and her compact. Johnson, though, was not the only person that had been examined in connection with Kim's disappearance. Michael Wayne McGray is a serial killer with 6 confirmed victims and upwards of 18 for which he is suspected. McGray himself claims 16 victims, though there's never been enough to confirm that beyond six, although he did later commit a seventh. His murders took place between 1985 and 1999, when he was arrested and ultimately sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for 25 years. Several other life sentences have since been added due to continued prosecution for other crimes. While McGray has been very outspoken about his potential list of victims, much like so many other serial killers, a lot of his claims are unsubstantiated. However, he was asked about Kim's disappearance and claimed that, while her name sounded familiar, he couldn't confirm that she was one of his victims. Take that for what it's worth, I suppose. There is another person of interest, but this one's a bit confusing and seems to spin out of a single article written in 1998 and later reprinted in 2014. The article written by Amy Pugsley Fraser and Eva Orr for the Chronicle Herald discusses the execution of a search warrant which reportedly took place in the spring of 1997. According to Fraser and Orr, police served a search warrant on a man who was allegedly obsessed with Kim. While the man's name is not given, some details about him reveal that he was in his 30s, lived in the west end of Halifax, and worked in the area of Quinpool Road, the same road Canadian Tire is on. According to documents unearthed by the reporters, the man was obsessed with Kim, and in their application for the search warrant, investigators specified that they believed the man had likely killed Kim and kept souvenirs from the crime. Allegedly, when questioned by police, the man admitted not only to knowing Kim, but to speaking with her the day she vanished. Fraser and Orr go on, explaining that the man claimed to be in love with Kim and apparently told authorities that he believed she had been abducted, abused, and killed. He also apparently admitted to following her home sometimes just to feel close to her. When police executed their search, they found photographs of Kim hanging on his walls, including copies of her missing persons flyer and enlarged photographs, presumably taken from local newspapers. Beyond that, they specify that police seized, quote, a handwritten book dedicated to Kimberly McAndrew, six strips of film, five slides, women's makeup, a white envelope containing pictures of McAndrew, a red wallet, and a blue knapsack, end quote. If you'll recall, Kim's sister specified that she had a blue bag with her when she disappeared. However, there's never been any information to suggest that the bag found in this man's home was actually Kim's bag. In fact, there's no specific details about that bag at all. There were other items in the home of interest to police, true crime books including the Casebook on Murder and the Encyclopedia of Modern Murder, in addition to newspaper articles discussing Paul Bernardo, a Canadian serial killer and rapist who had been active in Toronto suburbs between 1986 and 1992. There were also clippings about the disappearance and murder of Andrea King. I should note, though, all of this information comes from a single article, and there's not a whisper of this anywhere else unless it is directly quoting this article. The article itself isn't even available in its entirety online. A series of snippets are available on several websites, but the article itself is behind a paywall for the Herald Chronicle Archives, though their site seems to be broken as you can't complete the transaction to buy access to this article or any other. Despite my sincerest efforts, I couldn't find another mention of this person of interest. The fact that Kim's bag may have been recovered, that someone was obsessed with her and had photos everywhere, or that a search warrant was ever executed. You might be wondering why there's no further information available, and I am as well. But this also apparently happened the same year that Johnson came on the radar. All I can tell you for certain is that whoever the man was, he was never charged, and no one has discussed him since. It's purely speculative to try and determine at this point, but it seems likely that police either failed to find evidence to connect the unidentified man to Kim's disappearance, or they found something to clear him. Either way, this is a very bizarre set of circumstances that, outside of a single article, fails to get a mention anywhere else in the ensuing 23 years. There's been a lot of theorizing, a lot of speculation. There's an endless list of questions and no answers to support the majority of them. Few details are agreed upon by all, but there is one scenario which seems to fit with most people's analysis of Kim's disappearance. Had she been grabbed on the street, she'd likely have screamed and drawn attention to herself. However, had she gone along with someone willingly, there's no knowing what could have happened next. Many believe in one of two possibilities. Either Kim was taken by someone she knew and trusted, maybe someone offering her a ride home or someone who convinced Kim to go along, possibly by posing as a police officer. The daughter of an RCMP investigator may have been more likely to trust someone dressed as a cop. While no one knows for sure, it's commonly believed that Kim left that parking lot Saturday afternoon with the person who is responsible for her disappearance. When last seen, Kimberly Ann McAndrew was described as being a Caucasian female standing 5 feet 5 inches tall, weighing 110 pounds, with a tan complexion, blonde hair, and brown eyes. Kim has a scar on the bridge of her nose and wore braces at the time. She was last seen wearing ankle-length navy cotton slacks, a white short-sleeved Esprit t-shirt with red and green squares, an oversized navy-colored cardigan, and jade-green flat-heeled slip-on loafers. She was likely carrying a blue bag with her. She clocked out of her job at Canadian Tire at approximately 4:20 p.m., exiting through the store's north entrance into the parking lot facing the Quinpool Court Apartments on Saturday, August 12, 1989. If alive today, Kim would be 50 years old. There is a $150,000 reward available for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person responsible for her disappearance. For nearly 31 years, Kim's disappearance has haunted her family and confounded investigators. Despite multiple persons of interest and different twists and turns in the case, Kim remains missing, and it's believed she's the victim of foul play. While her family has gone forward, they've never forgotten her, nor have they stopped wondering what her life might have been like, what kind of world she would have built for herself. While some family has begrudgingly accepted that Kim is probably not alive, they still want to bring her home. Someone out there knows what happened to Kim, and it's not too late to come forward, make a call, leave an anonymous tip, and help assuage the grief and pain of a family that have spent over 30 years wondering, searching, and hoping for a resolution. Her younger sister Megan told the CBC, quote, "We want to have her with us. We want to be able to bury her properly. We deserve to know, and she deserves to be found." Thirty years ago, Kim McAndrew walked out of work and disappeared into thin air. For more than 30 years, the investigation has gone on, covering the gamut of possibilities, from sex traffickers to an obsessive stalker, a convicted abductor and sexual predator, and everything in between. Despite exhaustive searches, excavations, and even the desperation of consulting a so-called psychic, the circumstances surrounding Kim's disappearance have remained, for the most part, as mysterious as that fateful Saturday in 1989. A shy woman who doesn't like to be on her own in a small town vanishes in the heart of a busy city center, and no one sees a thing. There were sightings, certainly, though none that have ever been verified, and one which throws a wrench into the entire story. In the end, whether or not Kim went to the flower shop itself can't be confirmed, and in the eyes of some, resulted in the investigation being distracted during the early days, the most valuable time. The flower shop is a good place to start. When the tip came in, police thought it was their break, a young woman fitting Kim's description buying a rose and a balloon at a flower shop in Dartmouth, just across the river from where she worked. It was her boyfriend's birthday, so the scenario made sense. However, over the course of the investigation, it became less clear. Why would someone who's known to avoid walking around on her own make the 75 to 90 minute walk through Halifax proper across a toll bridge into the Dartmouth area to purchase a rose and a balloon at a flower shop when she could have just bought that at a shop along the way back to the apartment she shared with her sisters? Right off the bat, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Kim got off work 40 minutes early at 4:20 and her sister was picking her up at 5. If she did decide to make that trip, why not call and let her sister know? Hell, why not just ask her sister to drive her there after she picked her up? She had to have known she couldn't make the round trip and be back in time to be picked up, so why would she have gone? Even if Kim had gotten a ride from someone, the trip still would have had her arriving back at Canadian Tire well after 5, 20 minutes after, if traffic was clear. And why go so far out of the way for something she could have gotten so much closer to home? There's a lot about this tip we don't know. We can't be sure the exact information that was given by the employee, other than a woman fitting Kim's description. I've never been able to find what time the employee claims to have made that sale, which would help in determining if Kim had walked there or if someone had given her a ride. If someone did give her a ride and foul play was ultimately the goal, why go to the flower shop at all? Why open yourself up to being seen, to risk being caught? The flower shop doesn't make much sense in this case, which is partially why so many investigators have since dismissed it as a possibility. It's still a part of the case, it's still listed as the last sighting, but it's never been confirmed. Could it have just been a mistake? Unfortunately, we have no way of knowing, but it's the outlier in this case. It's the one detail that doesn't fit anything that we know about Kim, and it's the one detail about that day which just doesn't make sense. Several investigators, including Tom Martin, have come to the alternative conclusion. It's their belief that Kim left the parking lot of Canadian Tire that day, already in the custody of the person responsible for her disappearance. If that is the case, it seems unlikely that she was taken to the flower shop. Early on, there was consideration that Kim may have been abducted by someone working in a sex trafficking operation, and that when it was discovered she was the daughter of a police officer, she may have been killed to conceal that crime. This came out of a tip from an inmate who claimed that a man who frequented Canadian Tire had groomed Kim and on that Saturday convinced her to go along with him. According to that inmate, Kim was in the process of walking home when this happened. Strangely, that scenario will come up in two other theories as well, but with different people being attached. The sex trafficking theory was dug into deeply. A task force was created. Sex trafficking was infiltrated by undercover police and multiple traffickers were caught as a result. However, throughout the entire investigation, nothing was ever found to make a connection to Kim herself. Investigators today have since looked back on that operation and consider that Kim was likely not taken into it and that the tip from the inmate had probably been a lie. Another inmate gave a tip which suggested that Kim had been abducted and murdered by people he knew and that her body had been buried in Sir Sanford Fleming Park. 3 days of searching, a failed polygraph, and a lack of corroboration, and it was ruled that this was likely untrue as well. In their desperation for answers, police turned to a so-called psychic who claimed that Kim was in fact in a park, but not Sir Sanford Fleming. Instead, she pointed to Point Pleasant Park on the southern Halifax Peninsula. It was said she was in a well, then she was in a pond. All searches in that area failed to produce any signs of Kim, and after 3 sessions with the psychic, police moved on and their investigation looked into other avenues. As the years have passed, police have become more grounded in their approach. The common theory now follows suit that Kim may have been taken directly from the parking lot of Canadian Tire the day she vanished, that she never started a walk home, that she never went to a flower shop in Dartmouth. 2 scenarios have been presented when it comes to how Kim may have been abducted from the parking lot that day. Either she took a ride with someone she knew and trusted, or she took a ride with someone she didn't know but thought she could trust. The 2 people who immediately spring to mind are the man who apparently spoke to her the day she vanished, the man who was obsessed with her and had an apartment decorated with photos of her. The other is Andrew Paul Johnson, who had, in the past, posed as a police officer to try and lure victims into his car. I think we'll begin with the mysterious stalker. I wish I had more to tell you about this guy, but for some reason there's very little information out there. In fact, there's only 1 article that has touched on him, and it's an article which is currently impossible to access. The Halifax Examiner wrote an article series about Kim's case and about disappearances and homicides in Halifax as a whole, which quoted from this article. That's the only way to get your hands on any of it. In the original article dated 1998 and re-released in 2014, 2 journalists discussed Kim's disappearance and the execution of a search warrant against this unknown man. Apparently, the man was obsessed with Kim, believed himself to be in love with her, had photos of her throughout his house and on his walls, had a blue bag similar to the one she carried, spoke about how he believed she was abducted, abused, and killed, admitted to following her home sometimes, and even speaking to her the day she vanished. So you may be wondering, why isn't there more here? Why wasn't this guy arrested, or why haven't we heard more about him? I don't have the answers to those questions. There's only a handful of possibilities. Maybe there just wasn't any solid evidence. While the pictures, the book, all of it is insanely creepy and scary, it doesn't necessarily amount to enough to charge him. Police specifically stated in their application for the search warrant that they believe he had killed Kim and likely kept souvenirs, but it doesn't appear that they found any souvenirs or evidence of murder. The blue bag is interesting, but I'd imagine if it were in fact Kim's bag, they'd have publicly stated that and gone on to charge the man, but they never did. They never even named him. I'd imagine if they truly believed this guy was their suspect, if they found more information or evidence, they'd have been watching him, seeing where he went, who he spent time with, checking areas he visited to see if maybe he had disposed of a body there. I can't tell you everything investigators did in response to this person, but given the utter lack of information, not only from authorities but also from journalists, it would seem they found a reason to dismiss him. The results of the search warrant point to a lot of items related to Kim, but that's what they were looking for. We don't know what they found not related to her. Did they find information about other disappearances and murders outside of Andrea King? What I'd love to know is, what else did they find? Was this a guy who collected newspaper articles about a lot of different unsolved cases, or just specifically these two women? All in all, it's a very bizarre story. But at the end of the day, it appears to be the story of a creepy man who had an obsession with Kim. I know how horrible that sounds. It makes him sound ridiculously guilty, but there's nothing more we can add to it. I'd imagine police would have searched any vehicles he had access to, done background checks, questioned friends and coworkers, worked to determine whether or not he had an alibi. The guy creeps me out. His behavior disturbs me. There's no doubt about it. But with so little information available, with nothing ever publicly revealed and stated by investigators, it's hard to put it on him. It's certainly possible he could have approached Kim that afternoon. If he had a tendency to follow her home from time to time, it wouldn't be out of the ordinary for him to be waiting around for her to get off work. He could have encountered her in the parking lot, maybe started talking. Maybe he had spent time grooming her, talking to her at work, gaining her trust. And then, when the moment was right and trust was established, he offered her a ride home and things went sideways. If the flower shop story is true, he could have driven her there. Maybe she asked for a flower shop and he suggested one out of the way, one where he wouldn't be recognized and neither would she. Maybe it was all meant to just be friendly, and then he saw the balloon and the rose. He was reminded she had a boyfriend and he just lost it. It's a compelling story, but it's also speculation. I fully believe, considering what he had in his home, if police could have pinned this crime on him, they would have. He fits. It makes sense. But they never did. Which leads me to believe they either found something to rule him out, or they could just never get what they needed. Considering how they pivoted to Johnson, considering how the 23 years since that search warrant was executed, no one has ever brought this guy up, no investigator has ever mentioned him, I tend to believe he got ruled out somehow. Kim's father was a former RCMP investigator. Outside of the fact that he had connections to the investigation, he also had his own skills and abilities. He spent the last 15 years of his life hunting for his daughter's abductor. I sincerely doubt that he would have let this man walk away if he didn't have something telling him that the man was innocent. Creepy, disturbing, and not to be trusted, but possibly innocent. Maybe we'll just never know on that front. I sent in an inquiry to the Halifax police about this, but I don't know if I'll get an answer from them. If I do, you'll be the first to know about it. The same year police were searching that guy's home, they also turned their attention to Andrew Paul Johnson. Johnson's history of violence, sexual assault, public indecency, attempts to lure children into his vehicle, and other various crimes is well established. This is clearly a sick and disturbed individual who's been behind bars since 97 and who remains there today, thankfully. Johnson seems to have been a focal point of Kim's case from the mid-90s well into the current time. Johnson himself seemed to ensure that happened by writing an essay about Kim when he was in a sexual offender treatment program. Johnson's been a person of interest in over a dozen homicides, let alone the attacks they know he committed, the ones he admitted to, and the ones he attempted. The two things which most strongly link him to Kim's case are the essay and the fact that he was dating a woman who lived across the street from Canadian Tire in 1989. The same woman he would later be charged with imprisoning and subjecting to multiple sexual assaults. Johnson had a tendency to pose as different people to try and lure in victims. In some instances in the late 90s, he dressed as a police officer, and in others he pretended to be a fashion photographer. Who knows what other ploys he may have attempted? The fact that he stayed at his girlfriend's apartment a lot puts him within close proximity to Canadian Tire. This means there's certainly a chance he may have seen Kim at some point in time, whether it was in the store or in the area around it. It's not impossible to imagine he could have focused in on her. With Kim being a shy woman whose father was a police officer, she certainly may have had a built-in trust for someone in uniform. If Johnson was using that ploy at the time, it isn't a complicated matter to assume he could have been involved in Kim's disappearance. He could have offered her a ride home. He could have approached her and explained that he had questions that needed answering. She may have felt secure around him purely because of that uniform. You've got a predator in close proximity to the location Kim disappeared from, with a penchant for impersonating a police officer. It's pretty clear why Johnson was considered a person of interest and why Tom Martin believes he's a very likely suspect. The question would be, why would he put police on his trail? He had to have known that writing about Kim would cast suspicion on him, especially since she disappeared and no one knows what happens, but he decided to write about her being abducted and assaulted. Was this an admission or a sick and twisted individual playing a game? That's a much harder question to answer. What we do know is that while Johnson has admitted to crimes in the past, he has never acknowledged any connection to Kim. However, he's never admitted any connection to any of the homicide victims for which he is considered a possibility. Andrea King's compact was apparently found amongst Johnson's possessions, yet he's never been charged with her murder, and I can't begin to explain why. It doesn't just stop with Andrea and Kim, though. Just 3 days after Kim disappeared, Leslie Levy was viciously assaulted and had her throat slit. She survived, though she later became overwhelmed with depression and anxiety connected to the trauma of her attack and died from a drug overdose just 6 months later. So why bring her up? Because Leslie worked at a restaurant on Quinpool Road across the street from Canadian Tire. So now, within 3 days, you have Kim disappearing from the parking lot and Levy, who works in the area, being viciously assaulted. All the while, Johnson's dating a woman who lives right in that area. Then, there's the murder of Jean Hilda Myra. On April 5, 1990, 8 months after Kim's disappearance and Leslie's attack, Jean's body is found beneath a set of stairs at a grain elevator in the south end of Halifax. Jean had been staying at the local YMCA, 4.5 kilometers or 2.7 miles northwest of Canadian Tire. Her body was found just 3.4 kilometers or 2.1 miles southeast of Canadian Tire. Interestingly, Leslie Levy was found just a few hundred yards away. It seems apparent to many people that there was a serial killer and rapist operating in Halifax in the late 80s and 90s, and for investigators, Andrew Paul Johnson is in the core of where several of these victims worked, stayed, or were last seen. In 2013, the dig operation was conducted on property owned by Johnson's brother, though apparently no evidence of human remains was recovered. Considering several of Johnson's alleged victims were found, having not had their bodies concealed in any way, maybe police believed he might have begun hiding victims. Maybe they thought Kim was one of them. The difficult truth is, we don't know. Johnson certainly is a very interesting person of interest here, and I can completely understand why so many people look at him as being connected not only to Kim's disappearance, but to all those other homicides spanning from 1976 to the mid-1990s. The frustrating piece is the lack of evidence. Outside of the mention of the compact, there's never been any physical evidence mentioned. How does a guy who gets caught trying to lure young women, masturbating in public, imprisoning and assaulting his girlfriend, as well as a 20-year-old woman with an intellectual disability, manage to execute multiple homicides without getting caught? There are those who believe Johnson is responsible for all the crimes, some who believe he committed only some of them, and others who think while he's a sick and twisted sexual offender, homicide isn't part of his MO. No matter what way you slice it, though, it's very difficult to ignore his proximity to the location of Kim's disappearance, his predilection for younger women, and his tendency to pose as a police officer. Kim McAndrew disappeared from the Canadian Tire parking lot nearly 31 years ago. For all of that time, her fate has remained a mystery, and her family has sought justice and to bring her home so they might give her a proper burial and have a place to mourn. Kim's father lost his life without ever knowing what became of his daughter, and today, the family fights to keep her name alive so that his search would not be in vain. There's a slew of unsolved cases from Halifax during the time that Kim disappeared, and for now, those cases remain unsolved. Sadly, without the discovery of new evidence, a helpful tip, or a flat-out confession, the disappearance of Kim McAndrew remains open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Kim McAndrew, there's a lot of newspaper articles and interviews out there. Her sister Megan has been very involved with the media, and the Halifax Examiner has done a fantastic series about this case. If you have any information about the disappearance of Kimberly McAndrew, please contact the Rewards for Major Unsolved Crimes program at 1-888-710-9090. There is still a $150,000 reward available for information leading to an arrest. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. It's now time to thank our amazing Patreon producers. Alicia Lorraine, Anne M. Bertram, Astrid Maria Nyer, Brett Eady, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Jessica Chagnon, Kevin Bonham, Megan Cotter, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Pamela Coburn, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah, Samantha Ford, Stephanie Eve, Stephen Weiland, Tara Doble, Tom Archer, Tracy Woods, and Travis Sepsko. Thank you all so much for your generous donations and supporting Trace Evidence. If you'd like to support Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to the website at trace-evidence.com. I want to thank you all for listening to this episode, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.